The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Nico?
Hey, Jim. At long last, huh?
That's it. That little bit of static and your blackout.
All right, listen. It's a strategy that always pays off. You make somebody want you really bad.
Well, Yasu, you're here with me now.
Yasu, yes. How are you there? Over there. Where is over there? What I'm calling you? I don't know. You are in New York or in L.A.?
I'm in New York.
I just want to make sure that where you are, it's much colder than Athens.
It is.
That would make me feel superior in the conversation.
We have snow on the ground, so. How is the weather over there other than no snow?
Nice and sunny today, a little cold towards the late hours, and very smoggy because everyone in Athens, instead of paying for petrol, are burning wood in their fireplaces, and there is a cloud all over the city. No, honestly, yes. The economy has led people to rediscover all their values of life. So everybody's burning wood now, and nobody's burning their home heating system.
So how are things over there after that whole crash and all the craziness over the last year or so?
Well, I think that the worst is over for Greece. Not that the new year is going to be any easier. It's going to be still a difficult year, but eventually we'll bounce back. I think after many, many years that Greece hasn't seen a capable, potent, and decisive prime minister, we have one right now. And he's done for the country more in 4 months than other people have done in 4 years. So it's looking up, and I'm terribly, terminally optimistic person myself, so I think the best is yet to come.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, when you got somebody in charge that knows what they're doing, it makes all the difference in the world.
Well, Greece didn't deserve that kind of fate that has lived through for the past 3 years, and that was due to corrupt politicians, governments of untalented and impotent people, and at last, I feel that a crisis always brings something better. We learn lessons, and the politicians learn lessons also, and hopefully those lessons will be enforced in the years to come. But I'm not holding my breath for that, you know. This is Greece. It's the Greek character. You never know what's happening tomorrow.
Exactly. All right. So, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're ready, we can just get started with this.
I'm absolutely ready. Absolutely.
In the Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, prolific genre-bending exploitation filmmaker Nico Mastorakis on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. On film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. With a background as an investigative reporter, concert promoter, radio DJ, and television producer, Nico made his move into film with one of the most infamous of the video nasties, The Perverse Island of Death. After a brief foray into television as writer and co-producer of The Greek Tycoon, Nico and his Omega Entertainment would go on to release one entertaining, unclassifiably expectation-defying film after another: Zero Boys, The Wind, Nightmare at Noon, Sky High, Glitch, Terminal Exposure, and more. Marked by a strong sense of characterization and suspense, as well as being blessed with a long line of named stars and those who would go on to become such, his films stand alone among independent exploitation cinema as being consistently entertaining, surprising, quality pictures that touch on the tropes of numerous film subgenres at once without truly being pigeonholable as any of them: action slashers, sex comedy spy films, slick mystery thrillers with elements of all the above, and more. A man with a great sense of humor about himself and his work, join us for an insightful and amusing interview with the one and only Nico Mastorakis, only here on Third Eye Cinema. We have with us today a man who's been an intrepid reporter, perhaps best known for breaking the news of the engagement of Jackie Kennedy to Aristotle Onassis long before the official announcement, a popular hippie-era radio DJ, record and television producer, and novelist, involved in a number of entertaining projects spanning and blending such staple genres of independent and exploitation film as the slasher film, the action film, teen sex comedy, science fiction, techno thriller, and even spy film. He's assumed numerous roles behind the camera as producer, writer, and director, and often all three at once. Establishing his own distribution company, Omega Entertainment, this man has been a true lion among independent filmmakers, working outside the Hollywood machine from his earliest pictures in the mid-70s, straight through the final decline of the medium in the early 90s. Coming to us straight from Athens, Greece, please join me in welcoming the one and only Nico Mastorakis. Nico, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, Jim. I love the introduction, and I think that speaks for itself, and I'll hang up right now.
Well, hopefully not.
No, honestly, I don't deserve so much hype, but it looks like you did your homework and you know a lot about me. Let's see what you don't know about me, and that we'll discover in the conversation to come.
Okay. First of all, let me say thank you for delivering so many gripping and entertaining films, because I really can't think of another writer-director who consistently is able to deliver such suspenseful genre-bending scripts time and again.
Well, think of Roger Corman. I think he has done much more fun stuff many years before me, so I think that if you were to compare me with somebody in the film business, I would humbly love to be compared to Roger Corman.
Most people I like, they tend to stick to one or two exploitation genres, you know, usually horror with some TNA sexploitation thrown in for good measure. But there aren't that many people out there, other than maybe Corman, like you said, who stretch the boundaries and tap into so many styles of film as you have.
Well, I think that jumping genres is a way not to get bored with what you're doing, not to be typified a horror director, producer, whatever. And more than anything else, it's the necessity of survival in a market that is changing so fast, you never know what your buyers will want 3 months later. And remember that my career in the independent movie business spanned over the blessed years of video, of VHS,
right,
of the industry's thirst, should I call it hunger, for product. And in those days, we did something that could never be done today and could have never been done before that time, the booming of the video business. We could pre-sell in markets like MIFED and the AFM and Cannes or whatever. We could pre-sell movies that not only we haven't made yet, but we didn't have a vague idea as to what the script would look like. And people would come in the office and say, what do you have? And you said, I have a horror, I have a comedy, and I have an action adventure. And they said, we'll buy them all. Blind.
Wow.
Sight unseen. That was a magical era, and I'm happy I lived through it, and I created during it.
And it's true. It was really a kind of a golden age. But I would figure you'd at least have a title or something to throw out to them. So you really just said, okay, I've got this genre, and they bought Sight Unseen like that.
Oh, listen, I had titles, and I had artwork as well, and I probably had the speculative cast. Of course, your ability to sell at the time was strictly based on your ability and your past track record to deliver. Not all people could pre-sell, and not all buyers were stupid enough to buy on a title. But we had a following of titles and buyers, and they came back again and again and again, which simply meant that they made money out of our movies. And I'm happy to say that my movies, in the hands of competent, imaginative buyers around the world, distributors, made some good $500 million for them and a little bit for us.
One thing I really like about your films is that they're honest in the sense that not only does the characterization come before the plot, which is unfortunately something we've completely lost in these days with quick-cutting comic book franchise films where everyone's sort of a cipher just there to drive some sort of a half-assed plot and get to the next explosion or roller coaster moment. But in terms of how you recognize and make it plain that you can't really trust anyone in the end. You know, everyone is sort of suspect in a certain sense, and you have to be careful and guarded and ultimately rely on yourself in the end, particularly in terms of the official line. You know, no one's who they say they are, and you kind of be a fool to give them any sort of power over you or your intended course of action. So where did it all derive from?
Well, let me tell you, you mentioned the contemporary today style of telling a story through movies, which is fast cuts and a lot of effects and a lot of color distortion and slow motion and everything else that the digital editing has provided filmmakers with.
Right.
I think that it was a blessing for directors like myself to only have to work with 35 mil film and cut everything on a Moviola or a Steinbeck, in which case we never abused effects because effects of that kind were very costly and we couldn't afford them.
Right.
So you had to tell a story by simple means, by doing everything while you were shooting the movie. It's a philosophy that out of all the directors, the CGI directors of today, one, Christopher Nolan, respects and enforces in his movies. He worked with real effects, with real action, with real cameras, with everything, without referring anything to post. So telling a story has been an ancient technique in filmmaking. The best stories were told by the filmmakers that couldn't even move their cameras. They moved the actors toward the camera, and they were simple, clear in geography stories, like the stories that John Ford, for instance, could tell without effects or without anything else. And I think that I was greatly influenced by Hitchcock's early movies, and every time subliminally and subconsciously when I was shooting, I was thinking of that way of telling the story. Probably it's helped in a way to tell the story in an honest way.
I also always go back when I talk about this stuff to Mario Bava from Italy, because the guy, he never really had a budget, and yet he was known for his unusual lighting effects and his special effects and whatever. He wasn't blowing a lot of money. He wasn't gathering a huge crew. He wasn't investing in something that didn't exist yet, like CG or whatever. He would just say, okay, let's move a couple potted plants over here, take this value straw and make it into a chimney. You know, they kind of move things around and readjust them, and somehow what came out on screen looks like a completely different location and a completely different set. And he did it in cramped quarters. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 13 by 13 rooms, things like that. So the fact that that kind of filmmaking, where you had to use that ingenuity and therefore make something creative, is just kind of lost because it's too easy now. Like you said, it's almost like a push-button thing. So people just go, okay, what's the out-of-the-box software give me? We'll tweak it a little bit, and there you go. You've got a movie. And that's, you know, you lose all the characterization. You lose all the hard work. You lose the ingenuity. So a lot of the whole purpose, the creative impulse, is just right out the window.
I believe that this is due to the fact that directors today, when they belong to the studio circuit and they spend an awful lot of money, they have the luxury of doing everything in the best possible way, at least in their own minds,
right,
in their own vision. And in the independent circuit, directors today have the immense luxury of very small equipment like digital HD cameras and smaller lights and smaller everything. And if you draw the line between the huge Hollywood productions and the tiny, no budget, minuscule budget independent movies, you will see that there is one thing in common: the abuse of technical stuff versus the clarity of the storytelling. Some people, of course, escape the temptation. They go over it, and the story is clear, and it's beautiful, etc. Like,
right,
if you watch Flight with Denzel Washington, right, you'll know what I'm talking about. No effects, no nothing, characters, story, resolution, drama, the formula of ancient Greek tragedy. Very
right.
Simple.
I'm just using rules of thumb here. Obviously, it doesn't apply to every single person that's making a film nowadays. But, you know, in general, we've lost this. We've lost the characterization first. We've lost ingenuity first. We've lost, how do I work my way out of a situation? And I know that the Italians in particular were famous for this, where they would grab anybody on the set, you know, the guy that was getting coffee, the grip. Okay, what do you think? How could we do this? And they would do whatever input, whatever worked, they would do it. And it would come out with something that was unexpected, unthought of, even when they were doing the script, and yet it works. And I think a lot of that, if not all of it, has been lost due to technology, laziness, big budgets, whatever the case may be. Let's go back to the early days with you. Tell us a bit about your days as a reporter, and in particular your experiences surrounding Onassis.
All right. I started very early as a reporter, just years before I finished high school, actually. I started working regularly as a reporter when I was 18. Of course, in a country like Greece at the time, it was easy to be hired in a newspaper because they didn't pay you, at least for a year. So I got lucky, I got hired, and I also got lucky to start with some big scoops in the first couple of months of my career as a reporter, and therefore get paid a minuscule amount of money, but nevertheless, I was out of the non-paid genre.
Right.
Of reporters in Greece. Of course, I was also lucky, being in Greece, to have celebrities, super celebrities, like Aristotle Onassis, coming in and out of the country all the time, and I was right behind him or in front of him all the time with a stupid small camera, because when I was a reporter in those days, you couldn't afford the luxury of having a photographer with you. So I was taking my own photos. Onassis looked at me a couple of times and looked at the camera in disgust. The third time I took a picture of him with Maria Callas, I think, he came closer and he said, "Nico, you cannot take Onassis a photo with this stupid camera." You need a better camera. And I said to him, Mr. Onassis, do you know how much my salary is? And he said to me, something that I really followed in the years to come. He said, Nico, remember that nobody ever made money working for somebody else. I said, what do you mean? Print my own newspaper? I said, yes, do that. So the very next day, I went to my newspaper and I found a huge package from Olympic Airways, no card, no nothing, a beautiful Graflex camera. And the next time I took a picture of Onassis with colors, he looked at the camera and said, ah, very good. That's a great camera. Just follow what he said. Nobody ever made money working for somebody else.
I know that you were there snapping photos of and breaking the story, actually, of his engagement to Jackie O. And I know that there was some kind of a scandal around that where he was upset. He didn't like the idea that you had leaked this to the press.
On the contrary, au contraire, he was absolutely thrilled that I was there. And because he knew me for many, many years, he pretended that he didn't know me when he saw me as a member of the band on the Christina, on his yacht. If you refer to his official biography, you will see that Onassis wanted me to expose the truth that he's going to marry Jackie. Probably he wanted me also to expose the fact that Ted Kennedy, who was also on the yacht,
right,
was not there with his wife, but with a call girl that Onassis had brought from Sweden. So He was a magnificently conniving old man, and I'll give it to him. Of course, I made the mistake when I was on the boat pretending to be a guitar player for a Bouzouki band.
Right.
I made the mistake to take a picture of the group with Onassis with a regular camera, not with my Minox, which was behind the chords of my guitar. And the Secret Service guy for Ted Kennedy saw me, came to me, tried to find out why I took a picture, because coincidentally, in the background, Teddy was grabbing a blonde, that Swedish blonde. And when I started talking to him, he detected that I was speaking too good English for a Bouzouki player. So this is where he started to suspect me. He searched my bungalow, the one that they had given me for the night, and found Minox films and confiscated everything. And the very next day, he decided to come to Athens with me so he can come and watch me play at the club, which would be detrimental. I escaped the island, swapping places with a singer on the hydroplane that was leaving the island. But that same night, I was arrested and taken to the secret police. Remember, it was the years of the military junta in
right.
Greece, and I was kept there. I was held in their headquarters for 24 hours, time enough for the police to confiscate all the incriminating photos, but I still could write the article, and the article read, the former First Lady of the United States, soon to be the First Lady of Skorpios. And that was
okay.
A scoop, because that was 8 months before the official announcement.
Yeah, and you actually tied into my next question that you'd also come under fire from the fascist junta, who were in power between 69 and 74 numerous times in your guise as reporter and again as television producer. So speak to this a bit. Were you, as I suspect, openly and actively anti-fascist?
No, I was not. I never tried to play a hero. 7 years of dictatorship in Greece were more than enough for anyone to know that no matter what you did, no matter how you spoke, you would immediately be incriminated, and there wasn't any justice during those years. Therefore, you would end up at exile or in some prison cell that nobody would see you again.
Right.
But I was on TV at the time. I mean, I started on Greek television on camera as a host in 1966, and the dictatorship in Greece found me already on TV. Unfortunately, TV at the time, for at least 2 years, had no video. So we couldn't cut, and they couldn't censor it. We were live on the air. The first time that they blacklisted me and they threw me out of television, I was talking to a little girl and asked her if she had prepared the Christmas tree at home. She said, no, my mother thinks it's too expensive. And I said, you're absolutely right. With the high cost of life today, how can you afford to have a Christmas tree? That, by the colonels, was interpreted as anti-government propaganda. I was ousted off TV the very next day, and because I was serving in the Navy, I was doing my service in the Greek Navy, I was really morally, not physically, tortured for about 2 years till I came back on TV. And the second time they kicked me out of TV was because I interviewed a 12-year-old girl that had married a guy who had the same name as mine and already given birth to a baby. That was interpreted as a sabotage of the morals of Greek family by the dictator Papadopoulos himself.
Wow.
And with his own personal order, I was ousted off TV for the second time. So you see, it went on and on and on, and I realized at some point that there was no way I could have a continuum in my career on TV. There was something else that I should do. And this is where I started making movies. I wrote and directed Death Has Blue Eyes, which was my first feature film.
Right.
And then the one that at the time looked like a horrible movie to make, Island of Death.
Right.
Not suspecting at the time that I was making a movie that would become some sort of a horror classic, a video nasty. Censorships all over the world would rave against it, and fans would die to get the original copy.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest, Nico Mastorakis. Coming up, we discuss Island of Death, Lou Perrina, and the Greek Tycoon, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Cinema. Gene, the host, has been real kind to me and put up with all my BS, so please turn in and listen to the whole little spiel we gave. Hope you guys get something out of it. Hi, this is William Griffey, original guerrilla filmmaker. I've had 25 features to my credit. I'm so happy to be on Gene's show here, and hope you guys listen. And if there's any independent filmmakers or film students, I think you might learn a lot. And I'll try not to do too much BS, because Gene's such a nice guy. So please enjoy the show.
Jumping back slightly, why did you end up leaving Greece in the mid-70s, which I believe was around the time that the junta lost power? Because I'd have thought this would be a perfect time for a return to freedom of expression and action, and yet you left the country.
I had left TV much before that. The last time they kicked me out of TV was 4 days. Let me tell you a very brief story. 4 days before the second coup, you realize that the Greek junta had two periods. The long Papadopoulos regime was overthrown by Ioannidis a good Sunday morning. And 4 days before that, I had taped an interview with students that had been arrested at the Polytechnic Institute Revolution. And that show, that interview, was broadcast on a Saturday evening. Sunday morning at 6 o'clock, Ioannidis had overthrown the previous regime. And I was the first one, Monday morning, that was ousted off TV for the third time. It was when I decided that I would not do TV in Greece anymore, and I started making movies. So in 1974, the only thing that I did for TV was the continuation of an interrupted sci-fi series, the state-controlled TV, and then I followed my lead, my intuition, my gut feeling, not to do TV anymore, and just simply spend time to make movies, and especially make The Greek Tycoon, that everybody was telling me, Nico, you know nothing about big production in Hollywood. You will never be able to make that movie. It's good that I didn't listen to them.
So your first picture, like you had mentioned, was the amazingly grim Island of Death. Now, I enjoyed this one profusely, but it was totally unlike anything else in your oeuvre. I mean, it really seemed like you were tapping into every taboo possible. I mean, you had gay and lesbian couples long before this sort of thing became mainstream. You had Uruglania, which is popularly known as water sports, rave, incest, bestiality, murder. It was like an exhibition of sexual perversities. And yet, strangely, it wasn't titillating at all. It was much darker. It actually reminds me of an Italian giallo, but with a strong sense of disgust about it, like you were appalled by the events you were documenting on screen. So what was the motivation for this one?
Oh, the motivation, my friend, was honestly survival. I needed to make money. I was in London trying to put together The Greek Tycoon. I had finished Island of Death, which was made on a very simple recipe. It came to me after I watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre and knowing that Toby Hooper made that movie for very little money and grossed an amazing amount of money. I said to myself, if violence of that kind can bring box office, then I want to make a movie on a disgusting, perverse, twisted, violent recipe, which was very simple. I made a list of everything that would be very embarrassing to portray in a movie.
Right.
I wrote the script over one weekend. I did the casting with amateur actors over another weekend. And the third week, I was in Mykonos shooting the movie.
Wow.
So my motivation was not idealistic, was purely materialistic. I wanted to make money to survive. That's it.
Well, regardless, it stands as an incredibly transgressive piece of cinema, particularly for something that's so mainstream and non-explicit in a certain sense. You know, it wasn't like you were actually showing the actual deeds on screen, so it wasn't, you didn't push it over the board into, you know, pornographic territory. It was just, when you look at what's happening, you're like, oh my God.
Well, listen, you're talking about 1975, so even what I put on screen, sometimes against my best judgment or my own aesthetics and taste, in 1975 or 76 was absolutely embarrassing, annoying, and disgusting. You need to know one thing. I showed the movie for the first time during the Cannes Film Festival, not in the festival itself, but screening for the buyers at the market. 90% of the buyers that attended the screening came out of the theater in the middle of the movie, disgusted with the movie, and all of them bought the movie. What does that tell you?
Wow.
Also,
so they hated
thing,
it, but they loved it.
To be honest with you, when I made the movie, or even when I screened it for people, I hadn't realized that I had made a masterpiece. And that's quote-unquote, okay?
Right.
I realized what I had made when I was in London, and the movie had its first theatrical release in London, cut by the censors by 20 minutes. And I opened Screen International, the trade magazine, the following week when it was out. And I read the review for Island of Death, and I was reading and reading and reading, thinking that somebody put the title of my movie on the wrong review. The reviewer said how amazing, deep, and esoteric it was to contrast the dark characters of the movie with the bright sun and whitewashed walls of Mykonos, and that was absolutely brilliant. And I was wondering, did I do that? I don't think I did that. Mykonos happened to have white houses, and the people happened to be criminals. But I didn't think of it this way. So I made an art movie. And through the years, people reviewing the movie, even young kids today that have their own websites about horror movies and cult movies, they keep reviewing the movie and keep finding stuff that I never suspect I put in the script or in the direction or in the movie itself.
You didn't know you were that deep.
But it's true.
So did you run afoul of censors worldwide, or was it mainly Britain with the whole Mary Whitehouse thing and the video nasty scare? Because I don't recall hearing anyone getting threatened with jail time for carrying videos over here in the States.
No, the States never had. Actually, in the States, it was sold as a theatrical movie.
Right.
And it was a time in technology that we couldn't send video cassettes to our distributors, so I had to send a 35mm print to a company which was called Bryanston. I don't know how good you are with film history and if the name Bryanston tells you anything at all. Does the name Lou Pereno mean anything to you?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I heard that name.
So Bryanston was the brainchild of Lou Pereno, who had decided to go legit in New York And he had started a distribution company with a lot of people, big people from the studio circuit in Hollywood, flocking to get his attention and sell their movie to Bryanston. I had sent Bryanston, I had seen the huge one-page ads in Variety, so I had sent Bryanston the 35mm print, and I got a call in London saying, we love the movie, come to New York, we'll talk about buying it. So I went to New York, and actually I bought a ticket and booked a hotel with the very last money I had left with in London, and I walked into Lou Perrino's office, and I met Lou Perrino, who said, Nico, you know, we love your movie, we love the music, we love this, we love that, so we'll buy it. And I said, wonderful, how much? He said, I'll give you $25,000. That was a mythical amount for circa 1976, okay?
Right.
Don't discard it now. So I said, okay. So he said, well, sign the contract. And then he took $25,000 out of his drawer, his desk, and dropped it in front of me. And I said to him, oh, well, I don't know if I should be going back to my hotel carrying $25,000 at 9 o'clock at night. And he said, okay, no problem. Mario! So a big guy comes through the door.
Right.
He hardly walked through the door. He walked sideways through the door and said, Mario, take Nico and take him back to the Hilton. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, my God, what if Mario has instructions to kill me and take back the $25,000 now that I've signed the contract? He says, thank you, I'll get a cab. And I left. And that was my sale to the United States theatrical rights at the time.
And not to spell it out for those of you who might not have picked it up from that story, but, you know, Lou Pereira was, to say the least, involved in the pornography industry.
Well, yes, he was. He was deep throat into it.
Right, exactly. So you can pick up.
And his father had been sent back to Sicily, if you remember. He himself was arrested and tried in a state that skips my mind, that still had anti-pornography laws, but he was quite a character. I mean, that meeting is really beautifully illustrated in my memory, moment by moment.
That's a great story. So what was amusing about all this was that it was hard to peg where you really stood on the whole thing in terms of the film, because beyond writing, directing, and producing it, you were actually also in the film in the cameo as a novelist. So it wasn't like, you know, you could have been too far against the whole proceeding. So
in that movie, I had to play a part because the guy I had cast to play the part wanted 20,000 drachma at the time, and that wasn't in my budget. So by playing the part, I saved myself 20,000 drachma.
Okay.
I wrote the lyrics of the songs in the movie because that was a part of me in the 60s when I had written about 50 or 60 songs for pop groups in Greece, and especially with Vangelis, who, after leaving Greece, became famous for Aphrodite
of Fire.
Right. And he got an Academy Award for Chariots of Fire, etc. So it was, for me, a part of what I did. Not best, but nevertheless, in an average way. I also had a problem because with my DP being tied up in a movie that was delayed, I didn't have a DP to start the movie. So when I started the movie, I had to do the lighting, I had to operate the camera, direct, play the part, and try to accommodate people by feeding them at night because the budget was so small,
right,
so small that people could only eat once a day,
right,
and that was dinner. But listen, it was an adventure for me, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot in terms of how to handle people.
Right.
If I hadn't made my continuity person cry every time she screwed up and I yelled at her, she would never have become the top script supervisor in the world, the one that Steven Spielberg wouldn't start a movie if she wasn't available.
Wow. You had quite a lengthy delay before reappearing in 1984 with Blind Date. So what was going on for those 7 years in between? I know some of it was taken up with scripting and co-producing both The Greek Tycoon and the James Earl Jones horror picture Blood Tide.
Well, after I had finished Island of Death, by the time that it was released and I started getting some money in London, where I lived at the time, I was at the same time peddling the script of The Greek Tycoon to all the major studios, who always came back to me and said, oh, it's a great project, but it's so legally risky that we won't touch it. I had the brilliant idea to take the project almost with a complete cast to the Cannes Film Festival with a huge party on a cruise ship that I brought from Greece, where everybody was killing to get on the boat, etc. And everybody had great fun at the party, but we never found a financier. Me and my partner, Lawrence Myers, we were sitting at the Carlton Terrace in Cannes the very next day, desperate that our dream was going down the drain, when a stocky, short guy showed up, and he looked at me and he said, "Are you Nico?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I want to buy the Greek Tycoon." And I said, "Sure, bud, get out of here. Don't play with our pain." And Lawrence said to me, "Talk to him. He's Alan Klein, the former manager of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, owner of ABKCO in New York, who ended up financing the Greek Tycoon." So I had to work on the rewrites of the script and the cast and the production and the distribution of the movie. And as a result of that, I had gotten a contract with Paramount Pictures. And that brings us to 1978. Well, I made my first independent movie called Red Tide or Blood Tide,
right,
whichever way you pick. That was my first independent after I left Paramount. After 2 years that I did absolutely nothing successful during my studio years.
Okay.
Does that cover your gap?
Yes, it actually does. Third Eye Cinema with our special guest Nico Monsterakis. Coming up, we talk The Beatles, The Stones, Predicting John's Death, Paramount, Bloodside, and Omega. Only here on Third Eye Cinema.
I am Grand Master of Martial Arts. My name is Y.K. Kim. You know, I truly appreciate for your interview that Third Eye Cinema. You are a great interviewer. I could not believe. And I mean, you are great a communicator. So you made me so comfortable. That's great. I want everybody at least to once watch my connection. And I really appreciate all audience as it listens Third Eye Cinema.
You had mentioned a few stories involving some famous musicians that you were involved with, bringing them to Greece, one of which was the Beatles, and another one was the Rolling Stones. So tell us a little about those.
Well, I wanted to bring the Beatles to Greece for the first time back in 1967, and I was negotiating with a manager, and we disagreed on an today's ridiculous amount of about $20,000. So instead, I decided to bring the Rolling Stones to the country, and I booked them for the 17th of April, 1967, which was 4 days before the military coup. The Stones were surrounded by stories of drugs, etc., etc., so the local police felt very protective of the youth of the country, and they blockaded the whole route from the airport to the Hilton Hotel. We had a lot of problems with them because they were the bad boys of rock, so they did horrendous things at the Hilton. The Hilton wanted to kick them out of the hotel. We managed to convince them to give us some slack, and then the concert itself was anything but uneventful because the police had surrounded the stadium and they were clobbering kids that were going to buy tickets. They would only allow kids that had bought the tickets, that had pre-bought the tickets. The concert started with police on every row or everywhere in the stadium. Kids couldn't stand up and dance to the beat of the Stones music because the police made them sit down again. And at some point, one of Mick Jagger's aides, managers, assistants, whatever, was given a bouquet of red carnations. And upon Mick Jagger's instructions, he ran to the stalls, to the stadium, to give it to the people, where red was the signature, the trademark of the Communist Party in Greece. Police started beating him to return him to the arena, and we had to cut the concert short. Stones came to my office the very next day, and they got their money in drachma, in a suitcase, because they were in a hurry to get out of the country. It was a very tense, politically tense time in Greece, and it was detonated in the worst possible way 4 days after the 21st of April, the day of the military junta.
Wow.
I got to meet the Beatles later on in 1967. Although they were banned by the dictatorship, the colonels wouldn't allow even their name to be mentioned on a radio or TV or anywhere else. They expressed the desire and the intention to buy an island in Evia, and Alex Mardas was very close to them at the time, brought them to Greece, called me and said, "Do you want to meet the Beatles?" And this is how I met the Beatles, and I became friends with John Mosley and Paul.
And what was the story you mentioned relating to John's death?
A couple of years later, John was in Athens with Yoko, and they wanted to go on a yacht. I think it was Donovan's yacht, go around the Greek islands. And the one day that they stayed in Athens, John and Yoko asked me to take them to every coffee cup reader, card reader, and astrologer in town, which I did reluctantly. And after about 16 of them, we ended up to a woman that didn't know who Yoko or John were.
Right.
So she looked at the palm of his hand and she said, "Oh, my boy, you should be very careful because they're going to shoot you. You're going to be shot on an island."
Wow.
Now, I didn't want to translate that exactly, so I fudged it a little bit.
Right.
But Yoko, being as shrewd and very intelligent as she was, she read something in the tone of my voice and says, "No, Nico, please translate exactly," which I did. Very next day, instead of them getting on the yacht, they got back on a plane back to London because they were thinking, Greece, islands, are you going to be shot? You better avoid it. The year 2000, I'm sitting in a New York studio with Yoko, and I mentioned to her that specific story, and she freezes and turns completely pale, and she says, "Nico, we couldn't think of that, and I didn't think of that afterwards. Manhattan is an island."
Wow. That's kind of creepy.
It's creepy because the prediction was so many years before his death, before he was shot on an island.
So you'd also mentioned something about movies that you didn't make at Paramount, something involving Ridley Scott and John Carpenter?
Oh, yes. The interesting part of my tenure, the 2 years I spent at Paramount, is not about the movies I made, but about the movies I didn't make. And not about the great directors I worked with, but the great directors I didn't work with. And that was all thanks to the late, great, with a little bit of sarcasm, Don Simpson, who was VP of production at Paramount. I took to him a very, very exciting thriller, horror, sci-fi project that I will not name. And he said to me, "You know, Nico, horror is coming to the end of its cycle with The Omen and everything else. But if you get yourself a very good director to back this up, we may consider it." So I went to London and I met with a first-time director who had done The Duelist at the time, gave him the script to read. He read it. He loved it. He said, "I'm in." I went back to Los Angeles the very next day, walked into Don Simpson's office, and I said, "Don, I got a great director. I think he's terrific. His name is Ridley Scott." Don Simpson looked at me and he said, "Nico, you know, you are from Europe and you don't understand Hollywood. Ridley Scott is an artsy-fartsy director. We'll probably give him a small budget movie like Tristan and Isolde to direct." And, of course, he was wrong. He was wrong when I took a very unique concept to him that John Carpenter, who had just come out of writing the script for Eyes of Laura Mars, wanted badly to write, under the condition that he would also direct. And Don Simpson said, "John Carpenter, he's a hack. We wouldn't even give him a low budget to direct." He was wrong again. But, you know, those are stories worth telling. but you gain nothing out of it. People
right.
who made movies with John Carpenter and with Ridley Scott make a few $100 million, and I didn't. So I'm the loser.
Well, they're still good stories. So let's get back to your own oath. Blood Tide was interesting. It fell somewhere between Land of the Minotaur and Mario Baino's Dark Waters. So what inspired this one, and what was with that inverted breast cancer ribbon that the gorgeous Deborah Shelton kept dreaming about?
Well, every movie has, I think you're trying to find the motivation for making movies, but in those days, the main motivation for making a movie was survival and the desire to be on the set. It was at the time that I left Paramount after I blasted Don Simpson with a memorandum that I plastered all over the administration building. That was the end of my relationship with Paramount before the end of the 2 years. Charlie Bluedorn wanted me to stay, and I thought this is a good time for me to go independent. I knew at the time that being independent is not easy, but luckily enough, 3 days later in London, met with the guy that was running Hemdale, and he offered me $3 million to make a movie, provided that the movie could be made in 2 months. I had the script of Blood Tide ready, so it was feasible. We started, we cast the movie quickly. We set it up in Monemvasia, which was a unique location for the movie. And then throughout the first 2 weeks of the movie, we found out that the people who were financing the movie were embezzling money from pensioners that they were supposed to have invested in Selfridges and Harrods, and instead they were financing a movie. So that means the production ran out of money. The so-called executive producer, Don Langdon, that had brought a big yacht and was playing Playboy acts in Greece, found his luggage on the dock, and the yacht had departed for England because it hadn't been paid. And then I had to raise patience and tolerance to the Greek crew and put also some of my own money to feed them so that we can finish the picture. And we did.
Wow.
But other than that, there was no specific motivation for writing this specific concept. It was one of the concepts that at the time looked good. It didn't look good on film, and I'm sorry I made it, but then again, I'm sorry for half the movies I have made.
But this was also, it kind of started a trend that you have of picking up big-name Hollywood people, because you had James Earl Jones in it. So how did you land him for this project?
Oh, we had Martin Cove. We had that wonderful lady, Lila Kedrova, that was such a wonderful actress in Zorba the Greek.
Right.
We had Deborah Shelton. We had, you know, the thing is that I have been lucky, because why did I pick that unknown Kirstie Alley for Blind Date, for instance? Or why did I give a two-line part to Valeria Golino in Blind Date?
Right.
Why did I get an unknown composer from London to score Terminal Exposure, although his name meant nothing and it was Hans Zimmer? I don't know. I think having an eye for talent is magical, and it's also, it's not a secret recipe, so I can reveal it, but it probably is the fact that you go along with your gut feeling without imposition and restrictions from a studio executive who will come to you and say, Ridley Scott is an artsy-fartsy director, he will never make anything big.
So after Blood Tide, when exactly did you establish Omega Entertainment? Because it appears to start with Blind Date and then run straight through to .com for Murder.
Omega Entertainment was in business when the movie was made, when Blood Tide was made. They created Omega Entertainment right after I left Paramount. And I believe that even during Paramount, the banner was there, the Omega Entertainment entity. The first movie that Omega Entertainment made solely financed by Omega Entertainment, i.e. yours truly, was Sky High. And the reason I made Sky High is because I had made a big sale of Greek movies to a Los Angeles-based video company. And I thought that with my commission from that sale, I could start the movie and finish it probably if I was lucky. I brought the actors to Greece. I set up the crew and everything was ready. And then that sale fell through 2 days before the movie was supposed to start filming. So I was left without money, and I used my American Express to pay for most of the stuff. I borrowed money from friends, and I finished Sky High with, again, actors that later on became stars, like Clayton Norcross, that became a big soap star. And as I finished the movie, I cut a trailer, and I took it to MIFED in Milan, the film market, plastered the whole market with huge blow-ups of the girls and the boys and the action and everything. And I pre-sold the movie practically everywhere in the world with a 20% deposit that I got on the spot. I was able to pay back all my loans, my American Express, and have money to continue the post-production. And that's the movie that really started the avalanche of B-movies during the years that Omega was very active.
That's amazing. It really is all about salesmanship when it comes down to it.
I guess that in those years, Gene, a 90% factor about making money out of these B-movies was salesmanship, and 10% was ability to sell. I separate the two, because ability to sell, a lot of people have salesmanship, not many people have. Of course, the fact of the matter was that you needed good product to back up your salesmanship, otherwise you would only be able to sell once.
Exactly.
But the fact of the matter that in markets like the American film market, the AFM, and Cannes, and Milan, there were lines of international buyers outside the office waiting to come in, and the office was packed, meant that people, A, had a thirst for video product, and B, that they trusted our product. Therefore, we could sell the movies that we wanted to make, and those movies didn't go through the usual bullshit of 16 rewrites and 20 changes of directors and et cetera, et cetera. We decided to make a movie. Like, for instance, I was in London sound mixing the sound for The Wind.
Right.
And I thought that now that The Wind post-production is over, I have nothing to do. So while I was at the hotel coming back from the studio, I started writing the script for Terminal Exposure. And
right.
I would fax it to Kirk Ellis in Los Angeles. Kirk would rewrite the pages and send them back to me. So by the time I finished the audio mix, I had also finished the script, and Kirk had finished his rewrites.
Right.
I came back to Los Angeles from London, and I said to my guys, hey, guys, in 2 weeks, we start shooting Terminal Exposure. And we did.
Wow. You listen to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Nico Mastorakis. Coming up, we talk Blind Date, Time Traveler, Sky High, Zero Boys, and How You're a Pervert. And we're here on Third Eye Cinema.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, one of the homes for highbrow interview entertainment. Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia.
And this is Tim Ritter.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Be there or be square.
So jumping back a couple of movies, Blind Date was sort of a sexy thriller that, as you mentioned, had Kirstie Alley before Cheers and well before she ballooned up to her latter-day weight. Plus, you had Marina Sirtis pre-Star Trek. You had Keira Delia from 2001 and the late Lana Clarkson, who was shot by Phil Spector. But while it was much more indicative of where you would take things from here on out, there was something a bit off about it. It had elements of .com for Murder, maybe, but it doesn't quite click. What were you shooting for with this film?
Well, I loved the idea of a blind eyewitness, and I worked on the script, and I did the casting again with the same process of having an eye for talent, which was who impressed me the most. Marina Sirtis was in the movie by accident, not hers, but somebody else's. I had booked a different actress in London that had an accident before 2 days before she was supposed to report to Athens, and the agent sent me Marina Sirtis instead, and Lana Clarkson was there for one of her first movies, and what a lovely girl she was, and what a waste of a human being she was, ultimately. But I think that if I picked a couple of my thrillers from the roster that I have made, I think that I would fondly pick Blind Date and definitely The Wind, so that you don't wonder about how I feel about Blind Date. And okay. I don't understand, what do you mean something was off?
No, it was just something about the feel. It didn't feel like the kind of films that you were making after this point. You know, there was something off about it.
Oh, you mean the style was different? Well, I don't believe in a pattern of a style that you follow for every movie you make. And B, before Blind Date, I had made A Time Traveler, the next one, with Pierre Dulé and Adrien Barbeau. And that was also a totally different style than the movies that I made later on. I don't think that if you watch, and I have a feeling that you have done that, if you watch a lot of my movies, you can say there is a signature style that cries Nico Mastorakis here, and even if there was no main credits or end credits, I would swear that this film was made by Nico. The Time Traveler was totally different than Blind Date. Blind Date was diametrically different than Sky High. Sky High was nothing compared to Zero Boys, and Zero Boys was amazingly different from Terminal Exposure. So, I don't know. I do things instinctively, and I don't follow any pattern.
Now, I was also going to say that you can tell you were shooting for something along the lines of Blow Up, you know, either film with that title, actually, but the whole conceit of the computerized vision analog for the blinded hero was a bit odd. It presents far more of a hurdle for the character than was necessary, wouldn't you think? Or is this something you were actively shooting for as a challenge as a writer?
Well, listen, when a writer writes something which at the time looks very far-fetched, he's justified years after that. You know that the gizmo, the contraption that allows Joseph Bottoms to see in outlines in Blind Date was an invention about 6 years ago. It came out, and it's real.
Wow.
People can see exactly like Joseph Bottoms could see using a similar device. So I think that the idea of the device was the seed of the story for creating Blind Date.
I was thinking that was next up, but you said it was before this movie, was The Time Travel, which is also known as the next one, which was your sci-fi film. As I understand it, you actually didn't produce this one, but you did write and direct it. It was kind of a strange movie, or somewhere between a very low-key 70s-style melodrama about a widowed single mother meeting a man and falling in love, and a religious allegory about faith and Christianity rather than a proper science fiction. The scenes with the old drunk and Keir Dully tended to lean more towards a brooding metaphysical treatise on religion and belief in a corrupt world and tell the story of Jesus, who Dully's character may or may not be. So what were you really shooting for here? Because it was much stranger than the closest parallel I can come up with was Nicholas Roeg's The Man Who Fell to Earth.
I was not shooting for anything, but again, following my gut feeling, which is not correct or right all the time. But the magic about being free to make a movie that you want and you like is exactly that, to decide even against your best judgment, which, if you were asking me today, I wouldn't involve Christianity and faith and the brother of Jesus Christ being a time traveler. The fact of the matter is that the time traveler story, exactly as it was written for Time Traveler or the next one, was probably a very valuable concept or story, because I don't believe in coincidences. And don't tell me that Starman, that was made by John Carpenter, who was Adrien Barbeau's husband at the time, and who had read Time Traveler at the time that Adrien had the script, was a coincidence and so close to the story like Time Traveler.
I can hear that.
You can hear that?
Yes.
And I can also tell you that in his movie, John had a scene which involved gambling and the guy being able to predict the outcome of his bet that I had in my script, that I had shot in the movie, and because the movie was too long, I had taken it out in the final edit.
Right. And you got to remember, I just want to make sure you've got the same perspective that I've got. I'm not saying these movies are bad. I actually enjoy them. That's why I wanted to get you on. I was just pointing out.
Listen, I owe you a great deal. I mean, if I could reimburse you for all the time and the money that you spend watching those movies, I would do it gladly, because I am absolutely flattered that you did. So feel free to make any comment that you like. no matter whether it's defamatory or libelous or whatever, I can take it because, listen, I have seen a lot of reviews about my movies. I have seen some superb reviews in The Hollywood Reporter by Dwayne Burge, who reviewed two or three of my movies, including Zero Boys and The Wind, I guess, that he found amazingly spectacular and inspirational. And I have read a lot of comments in blogs and websites and everything, so I take neither too seriously. Whether you blast me or you flatter me, it goes by me and no problem at all, so feel free.
No, I wasn't even saying that. I just wanted to point out that these things may have been idiosyncratic compared to other parts of your oeuvre, I guess, and things that stood out to me, like, well, that was a strange idea. Where'd you come up with that? As opposed to, well, this is a terrible movie. That's not even in my head. So.
No. I understand what you're saying, but you should also understand that you being the viewer and the analyst and the critic, if we can attribute all those to you, you analyze and you find much more stuff in a movie than I had when I made the movie.
Right.
So that's why I'm not able sometimes to answer your question directly. It's not that I'm avoiding it.
I actually hear that a lot from guests. Like, oh, I didn't even think I put that in, but thanks.
Yeah. I mean, probably in the next movie, you and I should get together and talk story.
Exactly. Well, I've seen enough of your films. I could probably write one with you.
You bet.
In 1986, you put out the first film that, to me, really feels like you hit your stride, which was Sky High, A Summer of Fire. Now, I'm surprised that I didn't see those guys in other 80s teen sex comedies or what have you, because I thought they did a decent job, especially Daniel Hirsch as the nerd who turns manly. Bless. You obviously liked them enough to bring him back for your next film, The Zero Boys. But a lot of the standard tropes of a Nico Mastorakis film are firmly present here. I mean, you have pretty girls, you have the buddy film thing, you have this gorgeous Greek location shooting, you have some titillation, and you have genre crossing with a lot of twists and turns and some real suspense. And you would tap into this sort of thing numerous times, in effect building a house style for Omega Entertainment. You also started a pattern of releasing multiple films inside of a year, because the same year as that, in 1986, you also brought out one of my favorite of your pictures, which is The Zero Boys. So tell us a little bit about these two films.
Well, listen, after Sky High, which was a movie so turbulent in terms of financing that made us all, crew and cast, friends, I retained Daniel Hirsch, who was unemployed at the time, as my assistant.
Okay.
So he worked at the office, helping me with day-to-day business, et cetera, et cetera. And when I decided to make Zero Boys, and I was starting to think about cast, Dan said, oh, don't you think I should play the lead? And I said to him, Dan, from a geek in Sky High, how can I make you an action hero in Zero Boys?
Right.
And he said, give me a break and I will do it. And I did, and I'm glad I did, because A, Dan has always been a wonderful guy. He still is unchanged.
Right.
And B, because I think that in Zero Boys, he delivered what he's supposed to deliver. Zero
Very
Boys
awesome.
Was also a movie that did amazing, stunning pre-sales without any effort or any attempt. In one single AFM market, we pre-sold the world and the United States. And I'll tell you a funny story about how deals were made at the time. The big market in those markets in those days was Japan.
Yes.
So the Japanese buyers would come sit in front of you, and they didn't realize that in Japan they speak Japanese, but the numbers, when they speak about numbers in this case, they always mention numbers in English, but they don't realize that. So I would say, of course, I can sell you the movie, but I want 200,000. So they would start going, which no, 200,000, 150,000. So immediately I would know how much they were prepared to offer, how much they were prepared to accept, and I made the deal very easy.
Wow. But in terms of how the film was set up, it was kind of a strange one because it's a combination of a survivalist action film with a Friday the 13th style slasher. But it really works. And besides bringing Daniel Hirsch back for another lead, you also tapped screen queen Kelly Maroney of Chopping Mall and Night of the Comet. And you even have Joe Estevez as one of the demented brothers whose house they essentially invade to hold a party. I mean, just in that, talk about obnoxious illegal behavior. Can you imagine coming home and finding a bunch of strangers holed up in your house, drinking your booze, screwing in your bed, armed to the teeth with automatic weapons? You know, the heroes weren't exactly heroic here.
You missed a couple of names when you mentioned Estevez and everybody else. The movie also had music by the great Stanley Myers, with action themes scored and composed by the great Hans Zimmer. But I have a question for you, Gene.
Sure.
How many movies after Zero Boys have you seen that copied or imitated the concept and the story? So I could name at least a dozen of those movies, which, you know, us writers and directors love to discover imitations of our work, because that's the greatest flattery, I guess.
What are you thinking of in terms of these guys here? They were all basically survivalists. They're all armed to the teeth with automatic weapons. We're not even talking about, you know, paintball or something. How many? How often do you see that in a slasher film? That seems kind of unusual.
Well, listen, the main concept of the kids in the cabin was,
oh, yeah,
again, dictated by reasons of restrictions and budget.
Right.
You want to make a movie even today. I mean, people ask you, can it be made in one location? Because the nightmare of a production like this is moving around. Well, we had Values 8 Ranch in Los Angeles, in the Panga, and everything was there. So I had seen the location, I had seen the cabin. By the way, the house, the cabin that we used, was the same one that they had used in Friday the 13th. We simply changed the colors and everything else, and the furnishings. And I loved the location, and I wrote the script for the location. And also, I wrote the script again on the upcoming demands of our buyers. What our buyers wanted was action, which we couldn't afford to be big action. It has to be what it's called urban action, in a couple of woozies, et cetera, et cetera. And they also wanted suspense and horror. And I whipped it together, and we made the movie. No big deal there.
Yeah, it really works. It's actually one of my favorite of your films, but it was such a strange idea. I'm like, I've never seen something like this before. And then you said, oh, yeah, a lot of people copied it. I'm like, wow, I wonder who. I'll have to go look them up.
Listen, I'm no stranger to the term strange for my concepts. Even today, when I talk to major studio guys about development, et cetera, most of the times they listen to the pitch and then they say, well, it's a very strange story. And my get back to them and to you probably is that if it's not strange, it's not interesting, Gene.
That's true.
It's every day. It's TV. It's soap.
Make it
strange. Make it weird. Make it exciting. And make sure that it excites you and you feel that it's strange, primarily so that the viewer can feel like that even 30 years after you have made the movie.
I totally agree with it because it works. This is how I became a fan of your movie. So.
Well, listen, you're a pervert, and I give it to you. Actually, this is how I addressed the audience in a recent horror film festival in Ireland that I was invited to premiere the uncut version of Island of Death. The theater was packed, and I got up on the mic and I said, look at you, all of you perverts. And a thousand people started laughing, and they kept laughing till the end of the Q&A and everything else. Listen, I believe that in order to be a fanatic film-goer, fanatic member of the audience, in love with film, you have to be a little strange, a little weird, a little pervert. You have to have some kind of perversion. A good kind of perversion, because I think too much of everything is a perversion. And as people who love to watch movie after movie after movie, we have that kind of blessed perversion. So
there's some truth to
don't
that.
Don't take it as a compliment. You are a pervert.
I'll use that for a clip for the show. You're a pervert.
That's a way to close the show, right?
Right.
You're a pervert.
So
your enemies would love that. They would probably use it as headlines and blogs and everything else.
Well, there you go. You know, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Nico Mastorakis. Coming up, we talk Ninja Academy, Grandmother's House, and Dark Room, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
You then wrote, but didn't produce or direct, 1987's Terminal Exposure, which brought the first of three appearances in your films by Ted Lang, who's best known as Isaac the Bartender from The Love Boat. Now, this one here, I can never find it on DVD. There's no online sources that carry or resell it at this point. So tell us a bit about this picture.
You didn't find it on DVD for the simple reason that Toros, which had the rights for the movie, never sold it, although theatrically they released it with a lot of prints. They never sold it on DVD. They had sold it for video, the old VHS times, right, but never on DVD. And I'm thinking seriously of just putting it out on DVD now. So what was the question?
So I was just going to say, tell us a bit about the picture, because I wasn't able to see it, so I have no input on this one.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet? I caught you red-handed, Gene.
That's it.
I think I should end this conversation now, because I'm seriously offended. You misrepresented yourself, saying that you've seen all my movies, and that's bullshit because you haven't seen at least one of them.
Right. There's actually a second one, but we'll get to that in a bit.
It was a fun movie to make. As I told you, it was a movie that was whipped together while I was doing post-production on The Wind, and it was finished principal photography before I finished post-production of The Wind, which is strange. Fun people in the movie, both the two kids that played the leads, Ted Lang, Hope, the Playboy playmate that we use for the female lead. Everyone in that movie was a wonderful guy to work with, and we had 3 weeks of sun and sea and fun at Venice Beach, and it reflects to the attitude of the movie. The movie has a good aura, has a good attitude, which sometimes movies don't have because people chew razor blades while they make the movie, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes it seeps through the cracks and it reflects on the movie itself and the viewer can sense it.
Right. I should also mention that, just from what I know, that you also had John Vernon from Savage Streets in there, who would also turn up in one of your latter films, The Naked Truth, and another part for Joe Estevez. But that's all
I love to recycle talented people that deliver, that are professionals, that are wonderful to work with, that the crew loves them and feels sorry the day the movie ends.
Right.
Did you see me ever make a movie with Nastassja Kinski or Nicolette Sheridan again? Would I ever make another movie with them? Only if my both legs and both my arms were severely cut by some guy like Saw, then I could probably be forced to make another movie with those two. So that tells you the story.
Wow. So one of the earliest films I saw of yours was 1987's The Wind with one of my favorite B-movie actors, Wings Hauser. So tell us a bit about working with Wings, because I know you used him again for Nightmare at Noon.
Yeah, that was my main mistake. I live to regret the mistake of getting Wings Hauser for Nightmare at Noon. Nightmare at Noon was a 24-hour-a-day nightmare for everyone that worked in that movie because of Wings Hauser and because of other people, alcoholics. I tell you, having a drug addict and an alcoholic in the same movie is not the best recipe for happiness during the shoot. I had one shoulder to cry on, metaphorically, but definitely a true gentleman, a wonderful man, a man of stature, George Kennedy. George was there. He made the balance for all the unpleasantness that other people brought in that beautiful production.
Wow. But getting back to The Wind, you also had a number of great character actors in this one. You had Meg Foster from They Live, Steve Railsback from Life Force and Escape 2000, Ilya Kuryakin himself, Dave McCallum, and the great, in both senses of the word, Robert Morley. So this actually marked the start of the more star-studded pictures that you were gravitating towards in the latter part of your film career. So tell us a little bit about working with Robert Morley. Was he as much of an effete gourmand as seems to come across from his screen roles?
I have never met a human being to be close to what Robert Morley was. I promise you. He's an old stereotype of a gentleman, but with a wacky sense of humor, totally catalytic type of humor, manners that nobody else had, and also because he was older and very big, he had a problem of walking through the streets of Monemvasia, especially at night, but there was no electricity, there was no light, and he was too big for the narrow alleys that he was walking on. But listen, I think that Meg Foster, wonderful actress, wonderful face, wonderful, powerful eyes, made that movie work.
Yes.
And if it's strange that I got the concept for The Wind while I was shooting the next one, Time Traveler in Mykonos. I was living in a house at the time, no money for hotels and stuff. So I had rented a house that was quite remote from a little town. A couple of days were so windy that I wouldn't be able to either open or close the shutters of my windows at night. Uh-huh. And I thought, my God, why don't I make this kind of wind as the protagonist of a movie where he's the main enemy of everybody, but at the end, he is the only friend that my female protagonist should have. And that's how I started writing the script.
And like I said, this is actually one of my favorite of your films. It's very atmospheric. It's claustrophobic and yet open at the same time. I don't know if you can even put that to words properly. You've got that kind of openness to the island feel, and yet it very much is centered on the one or two houses and that little alleyway. And you really feel trapped there despite the fact that you're out basically in the wide open.
You're absolutely right, because this is what Monemvasia is. It's a peninsula in the Peloponnese, and Monemvasia means only one axis, which is the only gate to that ancient city. And the reason why it's surrounded by a fortress and it's got the old underground stuff is because every pirate of those times wanted to conquer it, and there would be so many bombs thrown from the passing pirate ships on the little town that
right.
people had to build underground dwellings to be able to survive it.
Wow.
So I'm glad that it translated to a strange, claustrophobic, but at the same time, open feeling. It's a feeling, Gene, like you are imprisoned with the ocean and the sky in front of you, but you cannot escape.
Exactly. Exactly what I was trying to get into words. But, you know, it's kind of hard to do without getting poetic. So thank you for corroborating that. And yet, despite all the familiar faces, the film's a very intimate, well, like I said, an intimate, claustrophobic feel, and it works very well for the type. Your writing really comes across in the final product. I can't say I've seen any of your pictures from Sky High on that didn't have me both interested in the characters and involved in all the twists and turns of the plot. I hate to make such a grand pronouncement, but I think it's a safe bet to say that after Hitchcock, there hasn't really been another true master of suspense. But I'd put your name forward as a worthy successor. You know, you really understand how to get people wrapped up in a film and concerned for the characters inside it. And I find, like I said, that I'm actually concerned for these people. And that's not something that I usually say with cinema. You know, I enjoy films, but I don't get involved to that level as a rule. Your films are kind of an exception there.
Well, Jim, I have to reveal one of my very heavy and serious secrets that not many people have a chance to hear. I was brought to this world to fill the gap between Hitchcock and the rest of the directors. I mean, listen, all of us small directors, small potatoes, think of ourselves big. Otherwise, we would be lost and crushed
right.
by our small size. All of us think that we're Hitchcock, because all of us felt goosebumps by watching Hitchcock movies
right.
that we cannot forget, no matter how many years ago we watched them. And I watched the first Hitchcock movies that I watched them in an open-air theater in Athens, crumbling and scrouging and climbing over the low stone wall and watching only half the movie, half the screen. Since then, everything Hitchcock, I love. So some of us copy the master. Some of us are hypocritical enough, as I am, to say we pay homage to the master. But for one thing, you're right. You can watch a lot of movies that are entertaining, especially in the low-budget category and the niche, but not many of them can give you characters to associate with and grab
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Most of them, especially the last couple of years, it's simply effects, scares, blood, ghosts, etc. And when the movie ends and you have been entertained, you find out that you don't relate. You don't give a flying whatever
right.
for the characters.
Exactly.
So you're probably right. I mean, it's to my advantage to think that you are right.
It's true, though, because most films, especially nowadays, but even in low budget per se, you don't really care. It's just kind of like you're looking at the plot, you're looking at the atmosphere, you're looking at the effects, you're looking at, you know, the mise-en-scene, if you want to be fancy about it. And yet the characters tend to just be ciphers. You know, they're there just to get you from point A to point B, or to showcase this special effect or this monster or this explosion or whatever it is, or just to make a point in the story. and yet they're not really vibrant. They're not alive. It's not like films from the 30s and 40s where these characters were there and you were invested in them. By the time you left the film, you were actually like, oh, geez, I'm glad this happened, or I'm sorry that happened, or whatever. And your films, yet they have that. They harken back to that earlier style, which is, especially in, you know, low-budget exploitation, is really kind of interesting. So I just want to
remember that I never felt like I was doing low-budget exploitation. I was living in an illusion that I'm making a big movie. Also, you should always remember that it comes from the quality of the person, the depth of the person, and the person that I had working with me most of the scripts. Kirk Ellis is an award-winning writer after we split amicably, of course, and he left from Omega, where he was vice president, and he was also co-writing most of my scripts with me. Kirk is an in-depth writer with a lot of affection for character and character development.
Yeah.
So that's why it happened, because at the time we didn't think we gotta whip a story with 20 explosions, 16 oozes, 5 cars tumbling, and a grand finale. We wanted to make the story work, and the only way, to my mind, to make the story work is make the characters work.
That's very true.
Secret, which is no secret. Everybody knows it.
And yet nobody utilizes it.
Not many people choose to. You know why? Because it's more painstaking in writing a script to bother about subtext and subplot and characters,
right,
and stories behind the characters, where they're coming from, where they're going, when you're dealing with an exploitation label. The mistake people make in the exploitation movie business is that they stick the exploitation label on their forehead before they conceive the movie.
In 1988, you were involved with a film called Ninja Academy, a comedy you directed and produced but didn't write. So what happened here? How did you get involved with this one?
As a producer, I was always open to suggestions from younger directors and writers, like I did, for instance, with Grandmother's House, that Peter Rader brought to me with his partner, Peter Jensen, who ended up being the DP of the movie. But Peter Rader was talented and he could direct. So he not only he directed Grandmother's House, but I also got him to co-direct with me Hired to Kill later on. In the case of Ninja Academy, a young director, producer, writer, whatever, brought me the project. We agreed to do it, to finance it and produce it. We cast it together. And then the second day of the shoot, when I went to the studio and screened the rushes, I thought that this movie is a lost case. Either I kill it today or I need to fire the director, and because I don't have a director available to go to the set today, I have to direct it myself. And I chose the second option, because this way people would still remain at work for 3 weeks and actors would still play the dream part and everything less. I shot the movie in Topanga Canyon in 3 weeks, and as always, I had great luck. I was shooting a summer picture, and the weather was so bad that we were walking on ice in Topanga Canyon. We had to have about 16 space heaters to put the actors in T-shirts shivering under the space heaters so they can do the next scene.
Wow. See, I wasn't even aware of that. But you
well, now you are. You see how much education you're getting from hours and hours of chatting with me?
That's exactly it. That's why I do this. So,
don't misunderstand my self-sarcasm as, you know, bragging about myself. It's the opposite. I take my job seriously, never myself.
Right. Well, that's a good way to go about life. So you utilize Will Egan, who you'd use again to better effect, I think, in Glitch. And similar to that picture, you used an attractive half-Asian girl who didn't really have any further screen credits. This time it was Kelly Randall. I believe the only name here was the B-movie screen queen, Becky LeBeau, who took a brief cameo role. The comedy was quite broad, and you could tell it wasn't one of your scripts. But that said, I really did enjoy the picture for what it was. I actually watched it with a few friends the first time out, and we all got a lot of laughs out of the mime character in particular. What was interesting about it is that while the humor was fairly lowbrow, it was far more off-kilter and unexpected than, say, a Police Academy or a Naked Gun picture. There was that kind of strangeness to it that said it had to be an independent feature.
And that movie also triggered a few similar movies, like Beverly Hills Ninjas, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That were made after that little movie. It was made on a very minuscule budget, had a very, very good commercial success, selling video, etc. everywhere. Although it wasn't my script, I kept doing rewrites throughout the shoot. I allowed the actors that I had to express their talent, but very restrained, because I was afraid that if they go over the top, that would be a ridiculous movie.
Right.
And I elected to do it on a subtle type of style, even if it was, if the script was broad and called for even probably bigger, bad meaning for big, but anyway, bigger performances. So it ended up this way, and I'm happy it did, because I too enjoy today watching it sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, because like you said, it's intended to be very, very broad, and yet I can see that you're pulling it in, and it makes it work, you know, as opposed to being something that's just so over the top, you're like, oh, geez, whatever. You know, you got to be drunk to enjoy this. You know, we were all sober, and we're sitting there laughing our asses off, so it works. It's a good film.
Excellent. Now I know firsthand from somebody who has seen almost all my movies, and I will continue to emphasize the word almost sarcastically, so don't chuckle, please. I know that I can do comedy as well, because to me, comedy is, I have great respect for Mel Brooks. I have great respect for all the comedy masters from the older days, from the 30s to this day, because I think comedy is a killer type of genre and the most difficult to do.
It is. There are two rather strange anomalies in your filmography where they very much have the Nico Mastorakis style and feel, but which apparently you neither wrote nor directed. You only produced them. 1988's Darkroom, and as you've mentioned, 1989's Grandmother's House. I really like both of these pictures, and I was really surprised to see someone else's name on the credits. So were you exerting influence and any sort of authorial control behind the scenes?
In both cases, I let the producers, directors, and talent completely free of my influence to make what I had previously approved to produce and finance. Of course, I was always there with them. I didn't stay in bed or I didn't stay in the office letting them do whatever. I would watch dailies every day. I would tweak what I thought was wrong. I would just enhance what I thought was working. And in both cases, I had people that were wonderful to work with. With Peter Rader, had a great relationship. We did Hired to Kill later on, but in between we stayed friends. And I was going to the Redlands, where he was shooting the movie, practically every weekend. Fridays and weekends I spent there doing rewrites with him on the script whenever needed, spending time with my actors, the two young actors that I loved, that were so good in the movie. And in general, I'm not an oppressive producer, because I am myself a director, a scriptwriter. If what is on the paper is translated to good rushes every day, I let people do their thing, and then I step in to do a much better post-production that they would envision or think they could do themselves.
Neither film had any real stars of note except for Brinke Stevens' wordless turn as the insane mother in Grandmother's House, though you did do a cameo as a judge in the swim meet. I'd comment on the apparent twist towards the end of the film, but if you weren't really involved as writer or director, I'm not sure how much influence you really exerted over the picture. In any case, both were great, and I'd recommend them to fans of slasher films or just suspenseful horror with a lot of unexpected narrative turns.
To be honest with you, looking back at those two movies, and I'm not a humble person, or at least pretending to be humble and modest, I never thought that I could have done a much better job or a better job than the directors and producers that have done those movies. I was always very happy with what they got and how the movie ended. So, you know, because directors and writers, deep down inside, they're always antagonistic to everybody else.
Right.
And everybody, anyone who tells you, no, we're not, would be a liar. We're always antagonistic. We watch a movie on the screen and we think, ah, I could have done this better. I could have done this different, et cetera, et cetera. Those two movies, I couldn't have done anything better. They were perfectly made.
And like I said, even though you technically weren't that closely involved, they feel like one of your films, both of them. So I was like, this is strange. You usually don't find...
You know why? Like, because when you pick a script among dozens of submissions, and when you talk to people that are planning to direct, you always try to clone yourself a little bit. I mean, you always pick projects that speak to you as if you had conceived them. And you always try to use directors that have a good vision, but not very far from yours.
True.
So you don't have to argue with them all the time, because that's what happens when a producer is also a director and writer, and he goes with the director, writer, producer, who has a total different vision. It's constant battle. It's constant combat.
Right.
I don't like that. I don't like the two razor blades.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest, Nico Mastorakis. In our next segment, we talk Nightmare at Noon, Switch, Hired to Kill, and Working with Oliver Reed. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema. High point around this time, because next you have another one of my favorites of yours, which is 1988's Nightmare at Noon, which also went by Death Street USA. And like we had mentioned before, you brought back Wings Hauser, this time over protagonist role, and you also brought in George Kennedy from Death Ship and Just Before Dawn, and Bo Hopkins from Tentacles, so quite a trio of character actors there. It's more or less your first straight action film, if you don't count the spy angle from Sky High or the survivalist aspect that you brought to the Zero Boys, but effectively at the same time, it's a zombie film. You know, it's very much in line with something like The Crazies or I Drink Your Blood. It may be your all-around most entertaining film. So I'm surprised to hear these stories from behind the set that it was so difficult on everyone.
But then again, probably you will notice in that semi-zombie, semi-sci-fi, semi-action, semi-adventure movie that the characters, again, are very interesting.
Oh, yeah. That almost goes without saying.
Let's flatter ourselves then to say that this is a signature type of method to write a script, no matter what the genre is.
You also directed what was your third film, and if you count Darkroom, your fourth in the same year, which is Glitch. Now, this one is the last of the films that I'm going to say are my favorites of yours, because while you still put out some good pictures after this, this marked the end of what I consider to be the highest point of your film career. You know, you were still in the game, but they weren't coming as fast and furious anymore after this. So let's talk about this picture, because for all intents and purposes, it's one of those 80s teen sex comedies, even more so than Sky High was, with more than a dash of a caper movie tacked in for good measure. And you carried over an actor from Ninja Academy, Will Egan, who had a very endearing manner about him, and cast a relative unknown, Julia Nixon, as his distaff foil. Now, I know she's gotten involved in walk-on parts for television, but like Will, she didn't have much of a career after this, which is a shame. You know, she's very strikingly attractive, and both of them seem to work well together.
Well, I think that the fact that Julia, who was and still is a wonderful person. She's one of the sweetest females that I have ever met. Very good actress. She's a wonderful mother, I understand. At the time, she was married to David Saul, as you understand.
Oh, okay.
And probably being married and being an actress and having an actor husband is not the best recipe for your career. That's how I interpreted it, because Julia, having a lead in a movie like Rambo, she was next to Stallone, as you remember.
Right.
She could have done a lot of action movies one after the other and become a big star.
And yet didn't. So, yeah, that's what I was baffled. No, she really, she's attractive.
I don't know. I cannot explain that. I believe that success or failure in movies is relevant to success or failure in life. So I hope that Julia is absolutely happy in her life.
And you also brought back Ted Lang for another appearance and featured an early role for Terry Weagle, who at the time was best known as a Playboy playmate and star of Cheerleader Camp and Return of the Killer Tomatoes before she fell into a long career in porn. So how did you find her?
I was looking for beautiful girls. She auditioned for me, and one of the things that impressed me is that she was the anti-stereotype of the girl who, during the audition, knowing that they're doing a sort of a TNA movie, they always ask you very timidly, well, I hope the part doesn't involve any nudity, does it? Terry was the opposite. She said, well, Nico, I hope that the role, that the part involves nudity, because I love to do nudity. And she proved that.
Yes.
She would screw up her lines, and she would make mistakes, etc., when she was fully dressed in the movie. But when you put her in a scene where she had her clothes off, she was absolutely brilliant. One take.
Wow. In terms of the film, at times, there was so much going on there plot-wise, and almost got convoluted. You know, it wasn't filled with suspenseful twists and turns, but there were a lot of loose ends that kept popping up to create chaos, like the two sets of thieves, the gay ninja bodyguard, who I was glad to see could actually kick ass when necessary. You know, the humor wasn't that 80s in that respect. The hypnotist bringing out the hidden intelligence of TC's dumb sidekick, Bo, every time someone knocks on the door. The casting party with all the girls. The continued vision from the police. And, of course, the fact that Dick Gauthier owes Ted Lang's mobster some serious residuals. And that's ignoring the main plot of the thieves pretending to be the director and producer, whose mansion all this nonsense centers around, on the exact day these two clowns decide to rob the place. I mean, it's a great setup, and you don't really let it fall into convention at any point. It's actually become the first film that I think of when I think Nico Mastorakis, for better or worse. So how did you come up with
it? It's good. I loved making Glitch because I like to live well. And in Glitch, I was in that mansion in Malibu for about 3 weeks, to the point that when I got in my car to drive away from the location, my battery was dead. So I didn't move from that mansion for 3 weeks. I had a great French chef who would come after the shoot and prepare wonderful meals. And I would have friends from Vestron, which was my main video buyer in the United States.
Right.
And other friends or people from the cast stay over for dinner. And one of the rooms in the mansion I had turned into an editing room and a screening room. So I could edit for a couple of hours. My editor would live in, and he would be willing to cook also because he was a great friend at the time. It was a movie with nothing but positive attitude. The girls were fun. The guys, Gauthier and Ted and everybody else, were wonderful. And I made it initially as Sky High 2, and then I decided not to connect it with Sky High. And I changed the title. As for the loose ends that you pointed out, you must also, for being absolutely fair to me, which you're not, you should also point out that all those seemingly loose ends during the plot tie together at the very end.
Yes, that's true.
And also you must admit that the idea of the guys to make the first major A-star porn movie in the world was wonderful and has never been made.
It's great. I love this film. Like I said, it's actually the first film I think of now. I think Nico Mastorakis. I love this
film. Listen,
movie.
I told you before, and I'll stick to that, I will reimburse you for all the money you spend on DVDs as a payback for the hours you spend watching my movies.
Actually, I was just going to get to the next film that I have never seen. There's only two of them. It was Thermal Exposure and In the Cold of the Night, which after a two-year break, you came back in 1990 with this film, which once again, apparently was either never available on DVD domestically in the U.S. or it's just not listed for sale or resale anywhere on the net.
In that case, you're wrong, because when we re-released all our movies in the States through Image in the year 2002, I guess, we did put out Cold of the Night.
Okay,
the only movie that wasn't released in that batch was Terminal Exposure, because the rights were with Taurus Film and we couldn't do it.
Okay.
But I think you're going to like In the Cold of the Night, because again, there is a small gizmo involved, a small, call it a medium height high concept that ties together and love relationship together with a lot of other emotional elements. A guy who sees a girl in his nightmares and he sees himself killing her all the time, and suddenly one day he wakes up, his doorbell is ringing, he opens the door, and the girl is standing in front of him, is not kind of ordinary story. And I would think that if I compared the attitude of the story to other directors, I would say that it is a little bit Hitchcockian, but more than anything else, Brian De Palma.
Wow, that's good company to be keeping.
Oh, and I love Brian De Palma. I think he's made some of my favorite suspense thrillers ever, and I think he's also at present a very underrated director. I think Brian De Palma is a great.
And it's true,
and he can still be.
It makes sense about, you know, you gravitate towards those that remind you of yourself, because De Palma is also a fervent Hitchcock disciple. It's very apparent, especially in his earlier material.
Yeah, all right. Let me ask you a trivial question then. In addition to him being a fan of Hitchcock and paying homage to Hitchcock, in which of his movies he paid homage to a French director? Don't chicken out on me now.
It was Breathless Godard that he was paying homage to, but what was the movie?
Well, I won't torture you, but you can find it and spot this specific scene.
Okay.
Body Double, where the camera goes around and around and around the couple. Does that remind you of any French director who had done that before? Claude Lelouch and Norman Fum, a man and a woman. He was the first one to do the 360s continuously around the couple in a love scene, in a standing up love scene.
You know, the last time I saw that movie, I was 18, so that was quite some time ago.
Oh, that was about 60 years ago. My God. I didn't know that you were that old.
No, I didn't see it in the theaters.
But all right, like, okay, you beat me.
Nonetheless.
In any event, do we both agree that De Palma is a terrific director?
Very much so.
Okay, good.
Getting back to the discussion here, you also directed a straight-up action film around this time, Hired to Kill, where you were on screen, if you will, as a voice on the radio. And this was a rare leading role for Brian Thompson, who was usually seen as a baddie in any number of kickboxing films from the period. He seemed a little bit uncomfortable in the role of a fashion designer. So was his over-the-top misogyny all part of the script?
Well, okay. Fashion designer, gay,
right.
Leading a Magnificent Seven of women to free a prisoner of a dictatorship,
right,
is definitely pushing the envelope. I will give that to you. But at this time, it's a great basis so that you can have Brian Thompson kiss the villain.
Yes.
You remember that scene?
Yes, I do.
All right. How else could you have done it if he wasn't pretending to be gay? And to start with, if he wasn't pretending to be gay, he wouldn't be convincing for his size and looks that he's a fashion designer. We had to go to extremes.
And the look on Oliver Reed's face when that happened was priceless.
What you probably don't know is that Brian Thompson was my former son-in-law at the time and the father of my grandchildren.
Really? I had no
idea. It was a family movie. Brian was also in Naked Truth, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
He played a cameo. And he played a cameo in The Cold of the Night that you haven't seen yet.
Now, I got to say, though, the sequence where the girls are training for the mission is kind of sorry, and the training looked more believable and difficult in Ninja Academy. You know, I wasn't impressed by the ladies' performance while they were trying to get ready for the mission. So what was it like working with Oliver Reed in one of his last roles? Because he's been known for being quite difficult on set and a heavy drinker.
Well, first of all, before you go on with Oliver Reed, because that in itself is a big story. Every scene that you saw in Hired to Kill and you disliked was directed by Peter Rader. All the scenes that you loved were directed by me. So are we clear about that?
Granted.
How was it working with Oliver Reed?
Yeah, because
it was a nightmare at noon, a nightmare at midnight, a nightmare first thing in the morning,
wow,
and a constant nightmare that never ended. I think that that was the man from hell for a movie.
Wow.
He was a man from hell for his wife that he humiliated and torture and splashed with wine on her face during dinner. He was outrageously drunk all the time. He used to have 2 bottles of champagne before call time. He had bashed me once. Thank God I have a very, very strong skull.
Right.
Or he could have broken in two. And the reason why he had bashed me is because he had a few days off and he was too bored being off. He wanted to work every day. He was a devil and an angel at the same time.
Wow.
He could come to the set and being hostile with everybody, and he could come to the set and being lovable with everybody. And he did something that no other actor has ever done. When you remember the scene where the very final scene for him where he's surrounded by the rebels.
Right.
And the helicopter with everybody else is taken off.
Right.
Well, I had a camera on a camera helicopter. I had the helicopter with the actors, a prop helicopter. We had the explosives and everything else and the extras and everything. He was supposed to look at the helicopter and drop his gun and resign and surrender.
Right.
You know what he did in that scene, Gene? He zipped his pants down, took his organ out, and he started to pee with 7 cameras shooting high speed.
You got me there.
You're laughing because the story now sounds funny. It wasn't funny for me when it happened.
I imagine not. You're wasting money.
Absolutely not. Actually, Oliver Reed was one tragedy in that movie. We had a second tragedy in the movie. The best pilot, the best stunt pilot in the world that had done endless Raiders of the Lost Ark and Bond movies, and he had done the most amazing, stunning aerial stunts was piloting a chopper with a stuntman on the skids and in the chopper. I was shooting some flybys. I finished and I told him on the radio to go land for lunch. And he said, all right, but because I'm not happy with what I gave you, and remember it was a simple flyby, not a stunt,
yeah,
I'll do another round in front of the camera, then I land for lunch. He lost control for unknown to this date reasons, and he crash-landed on the rock, between a rock and a tree. One of our stuntmen, the youngest one, was killed, died instantly, and the rest of the people had minor to mediocre injuries, medium injuries.
Ouch.
Now, that was the big tragedy in the movie.
Yeah.
It made the tragedy of having Oliver Reed absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Wow. Whew. Well, I didn't know that one. Well, anyway, you had answered with this whole business about Oliver my next question, which was that he seemed quite angry at Brian, and I was wondering if it was purely scripted or if there's something going on off camera, but apparently he was just like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, he didn't have to act when he was playing angry or unreasonably mad or whatever. I think the guy was made for that. God rest his soul, although I'm not sure whether he had the soul.
Well, if he did,
God rest it. He was such an unrested, restless soul in real life that probably he deserves to be rested off there.
You should have cast Klaus Kinski as well and made your life complete.
I'm not going to go to that story, man. Don't trigger me, because it's like pulling the pin out of a grenade. Don't do that.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest, Nico Mastorakis. In our final segment, we talk .com for murder, only here on Third Eye Cinema. Break, and you came back with 1993's The Naked Truth, where you cameoed as one of the guests at the crime boss's mansion. And this was another plot-heavy comedy along the lines of Glitch, but I don't think it worked quite as well. You know, you tapped into the bosom buddies thing, having the two Franks in drag for much of the picture. And once again, you surround them with beautiful women, this time related to a beauty contest sponsored by the mob boss. But the real focus this time around seems to be on stargazing. So how did you get so many name actors and actresses to take cameos in this one? Let me just name off a couple of them for the audience. You got Brian Thompson, who's a longtime kickboxing film baddie. You got Billy Barty, who's a famous midget star of dozens of comedies dating as far back as Elvis's Harum Scarum and owner of his own rock club in the 80s. You had Yvonne DiCarlo, also known as Lily Munster. Eric Estrada from Chips and the Andy Sidaris films. Norman Fell, who's Mr. Roper and the narrator of that ridiculous Don't Ask Me, Ask God thing that went on in the 80s. Lou Ferrigno, bodybuilder and star of The Hulk. Zsa Zsa Gabor from Green Acres. Dick Gauthier and Ted Lang make another appearance for you. Little Richard, Bubba Smith, softcore siren Shannon Tweed, John Vernon. It just starts getting crazy after a while. So how did you pull this off?
First of all, find another low-budget movie of any time and any genre that had so many guest stars.
Exactly.
Secondly, the secret of getting those people to work in a movie like this is very simple. Offer them decent money for a one day's work, and they're in.
That's it, I guess. Money talks.
Well, if I wanted to bullshit you, I can say, hey, you know, it was a wonderful script. They thought it was excellent. It was funny. They thought, I'm an amazing director. They were all dying to work with me because they all, like you, had seen almost all my movies. I could go on and on forever. But the secret is, give them a decent amount of money for one day's work, and they're in.
Wow. So there was quite a long break after that, nearly 10 years before you came back in 2001 with .com for murder. So what was that?
You know why? Because, A, there was a tremendous slump in the video business, and it was very difficult selling movies for video anymore. And B, because I was tempted to come back to Greece and create one network that soon became the number one network and run it for 3 years. And then after those 3 years, when I left that network, I was tempted to create a second network that quickly became the third network in Greece. So
wow.
It was temptation, creation, homeland, et cetera, made me take such a long break from movies.
So what occasioned your return to directing with this film?
My mistake. I regretted it. I live to regret it. And I will always regret making .com for Murder.
Wow.
Because my philosophy has never been that for the sake of making the movie, it's worth chewing razor blades. I love to make movies with people I like, with people that the crew likes, almost like a short-lived family to me making a movie. And that movie was quite the opposite. It was a movie full of hatred and full of jealousy and full of anomaly and full of abnormality and full of insincerity. And it was a torture for me to walk to the set every day and see the faces that I hated.
Wow.
And hated me probably.
Wow. Well, that explains why that was the last one.
It was the last one because the movie didn't make good money, and it was all my money in that movie, and that's why I regretted making it. I made the mistake to hire an actress who didn't disclose to me that she was a narcoleptic, and she took the job, although it was clear to her that we were shooting 3 weeks, all nights. Do you know what a narcoleptic is?
Yes, I do.
Right? And that actress, that specific actress who is not going to be named in this interview,
right,
was falling asleep in front of the camera while I was rehearsing, and she was asleep in between takes, in a couch, in a chair, in a wheelchair, and she was asleep even when I cued roll camera, even when she heard speed from the soundman, when she heard camera rolling, when she heard action.
Wow.
She was sleeping in front of the camera. And I had another actress that I would again not name who would come to me every 5 minutes and would say, Nico, fire the bitch and give me the lead. We'll make a wonderful movie. And that's the end of the story. You're not going to get another word from me for .com for Murder.
Wow. Well, just because of that, I'm going to jump ahead and not talk about this movie. Are there any upcoming projects you'd like to promote to the listeners?
I am working in the development of a major, major, major movie with a major, major, major studio.
Okay.
Which means that right now I live in what directors and writers and producers call development hell. Other than that, I am itching to make a horror nouveau type of movie that I will shoot entirely digital, and I will shoot it with 6 or 7 HD cameras and in a way that no other movie has been shot before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to tell you anything more, but I hope that I'm not going to make the decision to do that because I don't want to walk away from my big project till at least it's either dead with the studio or has a green light.
With that, Nico, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future to discuss whatever you have on tap.
I did enjoy it, too. I did enjoy the fact that you were wonderful as a host and the fact that you have seen everything and you knew exactly the questions you should ask. And
that's
when I'm back in Los Angeles and you're in the area, I'll buy you lunch. How's that?
Sounds great. Again, thank you, Nico. This was a pleasure. I really enjoyed this interview, and I hope to speak to you again in the future.
Thank you, Gene. You will.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye, guys.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Nico Mastorakis. Next week on week 52 of Third Eye Cinema, black metal maestro Adam Czars of Tribulation. If you'd like to join us here, contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician like to join us on here, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And don't forget.
Look at you, all of you perverts. Listen, you're a pervert. I believe that in order to be a fanatic film goer, you have to have some kind of perversion. As people who love to watch movie after movie after movie, we have that kind of blessed perversion. So take it as a compliment. You are a pervert.